Welcome to this afternoon's episode of At the Root of It. It's the 15th of December, and I'm broadcasting live out of Roberta's studio in Brooklyn, the Heritage Radio Network. This is Aaron Fitzpatrick and At the Root of It. We will start today's program with the Week in Wine recap. Latest news that Raylan Vineyards and Winery in Mocksville, North Carolina, has installed the first solar winery in the state. Though in recent years, dozens of wineries on the West Coast have taken advantage of state and federal incentives to install solar arrays, the practice has been less common in other wine-growing regions, mostly on the West Coast. With rising electricity costs, tapping solar energy not only can help minimize utility bills, but also serve as a source of clean, renewable energy. The solar panels are built in two arrays of 52 panels, each group oriented to solar south to maximize exposure to the sun, unimpeded by shadows from either buildings or the vineyard. Given the amount of energy wineries use from everything from grape press to refrigerated tanks, I'd imagine we will see more wineries adopting this practice in 2010. And in the crop report, Decanter reports that 9 Pomerol producers are protesting new regulations that require all chateaus to vinify in the appellation to remain Pomerol AC. As it stands, Pomerol producers are allowed to vinify outside the appellation in the Land de Pomerol, Montagne Saint-Emilion, for example, and still call their wine AC Pomerol. 23 producers have no facilities for vinification within Pomerol and will have to build a winery within the borders by 2018, which would be a huge investment. For some, it is only 2 kilometers distance from the borders of Pomerol Appellation. So it is quite close, but yet still not considered Pomerol AC unless the vinification is done within those limits with this new order. And lastly, in the market feed, Hong Kong has overtaken London as the second biggest wine auction market after New York, which, given their existence since just 2007 as an auction market, is quite big news. Hong Kong sales in 2009 surpassed the U.S. 34 million taken in London, but didn't knock out New York out of first place, where nearly 135 million was sold in wine auctions. The wine tax elimination in Hong Kong has contributed significantly to this development, as removing the tax barrier has brought the wine closer to the local economy and to wine enthusiasts overall. After this short break, I'm going to have a call in to the West Coast, to Washington, to my guest this afternoon, John Bookwalter from Bookwalter Winery. So we will be back after the break with John. See my chain stupid, and my wine stupid. Girl, I'm not stupid, but my not stupid. All said stupids, VVS stupids. Girl, it's Gucci Gucci, and my diamonds fruity. See my chain stupid, and my wine stupid. Girl, I'm not stupid, but my not stupid. All said stupids, VVS stupids. Girl, it's Gucci Gucci, and my diamonds fruity. That knee on my Jakey, baby, color carry bracelet, baby, wanna spit about 20 G's. Gucci drop 380, baby, multicolor clarity. Necklaces are heavy, man. Hit that club, then leave the club, then come back with another night. Mighty Mouse is icy, dog. What's up, sister, stupid? Yellow, blue, black, green, and white, the diamonds, that's the group is. Digitally enhanced, stone pink is like a movie. Truly, I'm a walking link. Gucci, man, the tongue, the tongue, the tongue, the tongue, the chicken, dog. Who you talking, tapping 30 in the kitchen, they about to go to school. Saturday I'm cooking chickens, mama about to go to work. Sunday Gucci cooking chickens, granny about to go to church. You are listening to At the Root of It with Aaron Fitzpatrick, and that was some music from our producer engineer this afternoon, Nat Wiener. And before I bring my guests online this afternoon, I'd like to thank TechServe, our sponsor, our Mac specialists on 23rd Street, and invite any listeners to call in at 718-497-2128. So I think I have John Bookwalter on the phone. Are you there?
I'm here.
Hi, welcome this afternoon. How are you?
Just fine. Thank you for having me.
Good, good. Thank you. Just before we started the conversation, I was telling you we just popped two 2007 Buchwalter wines, the Protagonist and the Foreshadow Cabernet Sauvignon, which are tasting quite delicious this afternoon.
Cool.
Yeah, so I just wanted to talk a bit about Buchwalter, the story of the name, and as I mentioned, the names of these two wines in front of me, there seems to be a theme to some of the labels and the names of these wines.
Yeah, all of our wines have literary terms on them, and that kind of began about 4 or 5 years ago when we created a wine called Chapter One, naturally taking advantage of our last name, Buchwalter.
Okay.
Didn't take a genius to figure that one out. So we created a wine called Chapter One. It was one of our top-end wines and only sold at the winery. And then we didn't produce it for several years because it's only the best of the best and only happens in certain years. But a lot of our clients that had the Chapter One were like, what's the matter? You got writer's block? You can't come up with Chapter Two? And then we started thinking maybe we could take advantage of that. And then we created a book club, which is our mailing, our club, our wine club.
Mm-hmm.
And then we started thinking, you know, this would be really fun, especially if we took a philanthropic angle to this and wrapped in some partners that are based around literacy and giving back to literal causes. So we turned around and partnered with Room to Read and the Reading Foundation and then a library foundation, King County in Seattle,
to give back
to their causes. So all the terms do mean something about the wines. Protagonist is a Merlot-based wine that's the kind of our central theme in Washington. And then Foreshadow is kind of an upper tier, but not at the very top for us. So that's, of course, something yet to come.
Mm-hmm.
So
interesting.
Yeah.
And I was reading a little bit on your website about Buchwalter and your roots, which I thought quite interesting. So I was wondering if you could talk about that as well.
Well, they go back a ways, at least as far as we could track them, coming, you know, out of Germany and then Switzerland and or Austria, and then coming over to the U.S. really in Pennsylvania in the 1600s. And kind of the neat thing as we went back and looked through our lineage was that we were tied to really farming in the soil throughout all the generations.
Mm-hmm.
Even, of course, most recently with myself, but through 11 you know, or so generations, we've always been tied to, in some way, farming or things that related to farming. So it was kind of fun to do that research.
Excellent. Well, you have been one of the pioneers in Washington State. I've yet to have a Washington State winemaker on at the root of it, so I'm very excited to hear from you how the wine industry has grown. And I was reading somewhere that the Washington wineries have increased 400% in the last decade, which I found an astounding figure. So wanted to talk to you a little bit about the growth of it.
Yeah, I mean, really, my father gets the credit for being even more of a pioneer than myself. We moved here in the mid-70s. He moved to us here in the mid-70s to start growing grapes. And back then, there was only a couple thousand acres of grapes in the ground. And today, there's over 35,000 vinifera grapes in the ground in Washington. And when we started our winery, when he started the winery in 1983, there were probably about 25 wineries. And today, there's just shy of 700 wineries in Washington. So pretty amazing growth, and most of that's really taken place in winery-wise and vineyard-wise in the last decade.
Mm-hmm. Now, you're based in the Columbia Valley, correct?
Yeah, in Richland, Washington, in the Columbia Valley, correct.
And that's the largest acreage under vine is Columbia?
Yeah, Columbia Valley includes all the smaller appellations, so it gets the benefit of that. But
mm-hmm.
Yeah, even if you were to remove the smaller appellations of Horse Heaven Hills, Walla Walla, Yakima, the Columbia Valley still represents the most acreage planted and also the most potential acreage to be planted.
And with this growth in the past decade, who have you seen spearheading new wineries? Who are these people that are building them, and what's the land that they're overtaking?
We wonder ourselves sometimes. actually, you know, there's a lot of land up here, of course. And, you know, we joke that, you know, the small countries in Europe could fit within in our Washington growing region.
Mm.
So really, you know, it has been some other agricultural products that were not maybe as financially or economically viable as wine grapes have been. So it could have come out of alfalfa or legumes. I mean, this is an incredibly productive agricultural belt, the Columbia Valley. We grow just about everything but citrus here. So we, you know, it might have come out of, again, one of these other row crops or maybe apples or another orchard products that could have come out. And some of it was raw land. I mean, really the key is if do you have water and is there a nice slope or a west southwesterly slope is what we've always thought we needed to really grow fine grapes and get them ripe enough. So, again, it could have been replacement. It could have been raw land that just maybe just had recently we got water to.
But you have the fortunate part of having older vines where some of these new vineyards in the last decade are new plantings, right?
Sure, but that's really around the world. I mean,
sure, yeah.
We can't forget that phylloxera devastated California, and you know, a good portion of all of their vines are really, you know, younger, very young. I mean, and certainly Washington, in global perspective, is, you know, most of our grapes are probably no older than 30 to probably the oldest are 40 years old that have survived the winters, and but most of the planting really happened again in the last decade in 15 years or so.
And what has been so attractive about the growing conditions in Washington?
Well, a lot of people forget that we're in a desert here. And I think in order to grow great grapes and really ripen them to physiological maturity, you have to be able to control water. And we can control water better here than anywhere on Earth, practically. We get less than 6 inches of rain, annual rain per year, 6 to 8 inches of rain per year, so less than Phoenix, Arizona, because we're in the rain shadow of the Cascade Mountain Range. And so a lot of people think of Washington, oh, that's all pine trees. How do you grow
in the
shadow
of but you're right
trees?
On the border of Idaho.
So, but where there's this massive, you know, northerly desert here on the Columbia Plateau. So that's where it starts. And we do get to irrigate. So we joke that, you know, the French, if they want more water, they have to go to the chapel and pray. We simply go out to the faucet and turn it on when we need more water in the summer, in the very hot summer months. So you take the control of water, very warm summers, very warm dry summers, long warm falls, and then our sandy soils and our northern latitude at 46 parallel. If you were to wrap that around the world, you would intersect some other famous growing regions, largely in France. You know,
the Loire.
Well, I mean, Bordeaux and et cetera. So, I mean, you really have it. Grapes at this level have been grown at the, you know, at this parallel for a long time. We weren't the first. So really those, the combination of those four things are what make this area not better necessarily, but unique, and makes it really truly one of the great places to grow grapes on Earth.
That's fantastic. You also have the westerly winds coming off the coast there, right?
Yeah, but we're considered a continental climate, so we're far enough inland. I mean, if I were to head out right now and drive due west to the coast, it would take me 4 hours to get to the coast, and over a massive mountain range. So we are far inland, and we do get winds. Don't get me wrong.
Sure.
But this is a very windy. It can be a very windy area coming up the Columbia Gorge. But that's also one of our advantages, because we don't deal with any of the pest and mold or issues that a lot of moist, dry, or more humid areas deal with. I mean, we are bone dry in this area, and also due to the wind.
And coming off the 09 vintage, I assume you're done with that now.
Yeah, we are. It was a quick vintage for us this year. So yeah, but we usually finish harvest, you know, by early November. So everything's barreled off and looks very good.
How was it?
Well, it was a compressed vintage. It was a hot, one of our hottest summers on record. And then we turned around and fall came in warm at the beginning in September. And then we had an early frost for the first time in 60 years. We had a frost in the middle of October. I think it could have been dangerous coming on the heels of a cool season, but fortunately it came on the heels of a very warm season. So the grapes were very mature at that point. It was just a matter of timing how you got your grapes into the building. So I think, you know, overall it turned out very good, but
good.
It could have had some dicey moments had we had a cooler season going into the frost.
And on previous segments, I've reported on the glut of grapes in California during the recent harvest, particularly in some of the high-end wineries in Napa. Just curious to know if there is a glut of juice in Washington wine regions during this period of the recession.
You know, I think probably in all wine regions in the world, there's probably some excess right now, and I think we would not be completely transparent if we didn't say that. How much I can't quantify for you, but Frank, most of the Washington wines are pretty value driven, and value can happen at $100 and $50 and $10, depending on the quality, of course.
Sure.
But Washington wines are not overpriced. There's not a lot that operate in that rarefied air of over $100 a bottle. So I mean, there might be a few, but certainly not. Several, we haven't seen the slowdown as much at that very upper tier because we just don't operate there.
Yeah.
But we have a lot of nice, really high quality wines in the $20, $30, $40, $50 range that really over deliver. So
I think I'm drinking one of them right now, this Protagonist.
Yeah, that is. That's the 07 Young Wines, but this vintage is fantastic. There's lots of fruit there and structure, and we've had a lot of success with the previous vintage of that wine, for instance.
And then with respect to the coverage of Washington wines in the past couple of years as well, I know there's been quite a bit of press. I was curious to get your thoughts as to how Washington State is being marketed as a wine-growing region, and knowing how much Cabernet Sauvignon is planted there, and we have the whites as well, not to forget those.
Yeah, sure.
How do you market your wines in terms of their style and new grape varieties that might be thriving there?
Yeah, I mean, certainly to start with the press has been really good to Washington State over the last few years. I mean, the Wine Advocate has continually come in here, and that's Robert Parker's Wine Advocate. They've done an extraordinary job of reviewing the state and seeing a lot of high-quality wines and giving them high marks.
Mm-hmm.
And then the Wine Spectator just came out with their top 100 list, and 9 wines out of the top 100 from Washington. And when you consider 35,000 acres are driving those 9 of those wines, that's an amazing feat because it's such a small footprint that's driving that. And we had in the number one wine, a Columbia Crest Reserve Cabernet this year in Wine Spectator was a Washington wine, made in some reasonable volume and for like $30. So the press has been phenomenal, and I think that's the rising tide raises all ships here. You know, as Washington continues to get great press from the wine writers, the consumers will continue to take notice of the quality that comes from here. And we are a great alternative. We don't mean to replace anybody's favorite wines or wine regions, but I think Washington offers another alternative to Bordeaux-style blends. We're really becoming, I think if you were to forecast 10 years out, we'll really be known for our Cabin Merlot and Cab Franc-based blends. And Merlot continues to be a real strong suit for us here. You can't discount Riesling as one of the fastest growing. It is second to, I think, Pinot Noir right now in terms of Nielsen's, the second fastest growing variety in the country. Washington is the fastest domestic growing region in the country with over 8% growth and Nielsen's over 52 months. So, I mean, the momentum seems to be behind us because I think we are a good value play depending on the price points. And again, it can happen at multiple price points, but I think there's a lot of quality in, again, $30, $40 of Washington wine.
And this might be a hard question to answer, but stylistically, comparatively between Oregon and California, for instance, most consumers tend to think that Oregon has a bit more of a European hand, and California definitely is new world in style.
Right.
Do you find that Washington comes in somewhere in between, or is it vary from winery to winery?
Absolutely. And it could. There's always going to be some variance. I mean, it's tough. When you want to paint with a broad brush, you always find these exceptions.
Sure, of course.
But certainly, painting with a broad brush, I would say that we are definitely old world and new world. We have some dustiness and minerality and some earthiness to the wines, but also some generous red to dark fruit tones, not jammy by any stretch, but I think there's some nice red to dark fruit elements there that marry well with some of the other tertiary flavors. And so we tend to say we've got a toe on one side of the Atlantic and then on the other. So it's definitely new and old world for us, at least how we typically describe Washington red wines. And white wines, that generally speaking, are probably a little closer to new world.
Well, that seems to make sense given the climate, the heat, if you're qualifying it as a desert, and then the mountain ranges bringing in those cooler temperatures at night. It seems that would make sense.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we are definitely closer to that.
And you mentioned Pinot Noir. Do you find that there's more plantings of that in the past couple of years?
Not up here in Washington. I just mentioned Pinot Noir as a variety that's, you know, continues to see positive growth, of course.
We leave
it to the Oregonians to handle Pinot
Noir.
We're actually too hot. I mean, really, in most of the climates that we grow grapes in, Pinot Noir would suffer in our tremendous heat. And you know, that's why we typically move towards these Bordeaux-style varieties, Cab Merlot, Cab Franc.
A little tougher.
A little more hardy, for sure.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, great. Well, we're going to come back and speak a bit about your role on the Washington Wine Commission after this short break, so please stay on the line.
Sure.
Welcome back to this afternoon's program. This is Aaron Fitzpatrick on At the Root of It. And my guest this afternoon is John Bookwalter from Bookwalter Winery in Washington State, Columbia Valley. Welcome back, John.
Thanks, Aaron.
Good. Just wanted to segue into your role on the Washington Wine Commission and the mission of what this organization does and addresses.
Sure. I mean, the Washington Wine Commission is a quasi-government body, but it's funded through wine sales, a liter tax, and then also an assessment per ton that are paid into the government coffers, and then they allocate it back to the commission, essentially. But our charter is to market Washington wines, and really more or less to create a positive awareness of Washington wines and to create an environment which allows Washington wineries to flourish and sell their products. And that obviously benefits the growers. So the growers and the wineries are all part of this. Obviously, without wines, it'd be tough for the growers to sell grapes.
Yeah.
So it's all hand in hand. So our job is really to create this positive environment that allows us to sell as much wine as possible.
So you're one of the founders or the president of the commission?
My dad helped found the commission 20-some odd years ago, but I'm actually the current chair of the commission.
Excellent. And are there, can you speak a bit about the regulations for growers with respect to percentage of grape varietals and things that have to do with vinification and viticulture?
Yeah, not so much on the vineyard side. Really, the gloves are off in the New World, and particularly in Washington. I mean, they can grow anything they'd like to grow.
Okay.
As a winery, anything they think they could grow. As a winery, of course, we in Washington mirror all federal laws. So, you know, it's the 75% of a variety to call it a variety. So we don't currently tighten anything up other than not being able to blend any other regions' wines, other like states' wines into ours and still calling them Washington. So we have a very tight policy on that. But outside of that, we mirror all federal regulations for wine production.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And with respect to the sales domestically versus abroad, how does that fare?
You know, still most of Washington wines are sold domestically, but we are seeing, you know, of course, some nice growth in markets like England, London specifically. Japan has been a good export market for Washington. And then, of course, Asia, specifically China. So we're seeing more interest all the time, again, because of the press and because of the value. And the styles of wine that we produce. A lot of these regions have been familiar with, you know, the left and right bank of Bordeaux, and now they're seeing in some of the Rhone varieties. I mean, Washington does a great job with Syrah, too, and so they're certainly starting to pay attention to and see Washington wines. But it's a numbers game. We're still a small, small region. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're basically the size of, we're even smaller than Sonoma in California. So, you know, it just takes time to have enough critical mass to share with everyone.
Of course, yeah, supply and demand.
yeah, absolutely. And it's also, I think now, though, too, with the domestic market being very challenged at the moment for wine sales, and people have looked further to sell wine, and because of the weakness of the dollar, frankly, our wines are even that much of a better value right now, particularly in European markets.
Yeah, and I feel, from back to the domestic standpoint, people are looking to support more locally as well, with the whole movement towards locavore, natural, you know, reducing carbon footprint, seeking things that are within our own country. Do you find that there's been support of that as well?
Well, you know, I'd like to say empirically, I don't know if I can prove it, but it feels that way.
Yeah.
You know, that's
yeah.
my sense. I travel about 150 days a year on the road, and there's been a real nod to domestic products, I think, and not that we're shutting out others, but I think they're certainly considering them maybe to a greater degree now. And it feels that way to me, but maybe it's because I want to feel that way.
Sure,
yeah. You wonder about that.
There is the perception, though, and I think that I've dealt with several restaurants who are starting to look more inwards and say, well, what can we support around here? And I know the restaurant that I work at, we've added several more wines domestically in the past year. So that's what people are asked for. You give them what they want.
Well, and I think the quality, though, too, you got to look at quality over the last decade, and whether it be from California, Oregon, Washington, even New York or other states. I mean, quality has increased significantly around the world and domestically. So I think they're worth looking at for sure.
Mm-hmm. Do you foresee growth from your winery in particular to Asia and other export markets in 2010?
Yeah, maybe a little bit. Again,
little
we're not a large winery.
Yeah, how many cases do you produce?
Yeah, we make about 12,000 cases of wine.
And, okay.
You know, I can sell a third of that or more through my. I have a retail store in Woodinville, Washington, which is near Seattle, and then my winery here in Eastern Washington.
So that's your own retail store then?
Yeah.
Oh, great.
Yeah, and then. And then, you know, the other, call it 8,000 cases, travel abroad, and most of that's sold domestically for sure. But I think, you know, long term, I think it's important to have a broad footprint and to sell wines in regions that people respect the wines and look forward to good quality. So certainly as I expand markets, I have to consider, you know, exporting to some degree.
Mm-hmm.
We export a little bit into Canada now, and certainly if the opportunity arose, we'd look at these other markets. You know, but I'm not in all the states still. So, I mean, I have another, maybe 15 states or so to look at domestically before I'm even complete there. And certainly we could do a lot more work even in the states we currently sell in.
Sure. Yeah, I heard about you through my friend and Adam Lippis.
Yeah, absolutely.
So he's based here in New York. And I imagine you're selling to some New York restaurants. I have not yet been able to taste one at a restaurant, but I hope look forward to it.
Well, there's so many restaurants there and not that much wine, but yeah, I mean, we have some nice restaurants. I think Peter Luger just put our wines on in Brooklyn there, so Protagonist for that matter. And
oh, really?
You know, those are the type of accounts that, you know, could certainly sell our product. But New York's a very competitive market, that area in the Northeast is one of the most, probably the most competitive wine market in domestically speaking, because you do get such an influence of Eastern or European wines, probably more so than the West Coast sees, or for that matter, the Midwest.
And when you think about the actual sales based on distribution as opposed to direct to consumer who find you through your website or whatnot, and the idea of highly allocated wines, can you speak a bit about that with respect to how many people actually do contact you through your website to order or reserve in advance the wines that you're putting out for the next vintage, and whether or not that's more of a marketing thing or in verity an actual reason to reserve in the future? I know there's a big thing in Napa because we all have all these wines on our list that are, you know, you can't get your hands on, Screaming Eagle, thus it's this much amount of money. But I'm not sure in this current state that is quite so much the truth.
Yeah, I would agree. And And there are certainly, let's be truthful, there's certainly wines out there that are incredibly highly allocated and worth that, and small supply, big demand.
Mm-hmm.
But the notion of allocations for most of the rest has largely gone away, and people have looked for more opportunities to sell their wines. So, frankly, it's probably one of the best times in the last, I can't really speak to maybe the last 50 years for wine consumption, because quality is high, prices are aggressive, mm-hmm. and it's a great time. Whether you're a sophisticated wine drinker or whether you're just starting, I think it's one of the best times to be drinking wines in a long time.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, I work on the floor as a sommelier, and I have a lot of people who are looking for that value, as you spoke about before, yeah. which then opens up a dialogue of conversation, because they're more willing now to utilize my advice for their benefit, as opposed to just picking a name that they know.
Right. Absolutely. And mm-hmm. even the names that we know, that you know, are may be at a more attractive price right now, and that's just the reality of where everyone's at, and that doesn't mean those wines are not good or they're bad. It's just the economic climate that
mm-hmm.
we're in.
Mm-hmm. Well, is there anything in store for Book Walter in 2010 that you'd like to speak about, or any of the particular bottlings that you've just released that we should know about?
Well, I think overall, I think for Washington, and certainly for our small cellar, the 07s are probably the vintage of the decade.
Oh, yeah?
They're just starting to squeak out, and really with a more or less a spring allocation is when they'll really, allocations, you know, release, that is, when they'll start coming, really seeing the light of day out there with
mm-hmm.
with the retailers and restaurateurs and consumers. So it's a great time to be shopping for Washington wines from the 07 vintage. And we've got a couple new blends. Conflict is one of my favorites right now. It's the sister, if you will, to Protagonist, and
yep.
another Merlot-based wine, but all from one smaller vineyard called Connerly. And it's
Shakespearean.
Early on, it's showing a lot of promise. Pardon me?
Very Shakespearean, these names.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So we're excited about that, and we did make a Chapter 3 from that we're on in 2007. So those are the blends at the upper end are kind of fun for me to create, of course, because they're kind of our pride and joy.
Sure. So the reds are really what you are behind. You identify Book Walter with.
Yeah, we're 90% of our production is red wine,
okay.
and that's largely
okay.
what travels across the country. The white wines are largely sold here. We run a wine bar at the winery, so most of the white
which wines, I heard, is beautiful, by the way.
Yeah, it's a fun place. It's
yeah.
certainly a popular place in our small corner of the world, but the white wines are largely sold here during the summer months.
Well, for our listeners, I'd love, John, if you could just mention your website so anyone listening can go and look a little bit further at what you do and your bottlings and your tasting room.
Sure. It's www.bookwalterwines, which is plural, WINES.com, so bookwalterwines.com.
Wonderful. Great. Well, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, Aaron. Appreciate it.
Definitely. And we will continue to support your wines here in New York.
Great. Thank you so much.
Okay. Cheers.
Cheers. Bye.
Please stay tuned. Why We Cook is up next at 6:30 p.m. And a thank you to our sponsor again, TechServe, and our engineer, Nat Wiener, and producer, Jack Inslee. Thanks so much for joining, and we'll see you next week. Pero aquel antifaz que por fortuna